RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So, to a discussion on Coastal Areas Amendment Bill, charter schools, and amendments to the Treaty Principles Bill that include pre-treaty rights of iwi and hapu. Takuta Ferris, Te Pāti Māori, is back with us on RCR. Morena, good morning, Takuta. Great to have you back.
Yeah, morena, Paul. Good to be back.
You've been busy? Been busy on many fronts.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But hey, look, you know, it's good to take every opportunity, in my view, to just keep putting out more and more clarity around these topics for everyone.
Right. Okay, well, let's get some clarity on this. You've demanded that the government, the Crown, prove its rights to the foreshore rather than requiring Māori to prove their customary rights. What's your, I mean, it's obvious there, I guess, from what I say, but more deeply, what is your thinking behind that?
Yeah, that's a pretty, it's a pretty simple and succinct conclusion to end up at. And I'll tell you why. The Treaty of Waitangi, Article 2 of the Treaty of Waitangi, recognises that all of the Māori rights that pre-exist the Treaty of Waitangi would continue on after the Treaty of Waitangi is signed. That's it in a nutshell. And so if you fast forward to 2004, there hadn't been an act of parliament passed that actively extinguished Māori rights to the foreshore and seabed. Okay, this is the explanation straight out of the court's ruling.
Right. Nothing before that.
Nothing before that. So what that meant is that even with New Zealand's parliament in play, there hadn't been an act passed that extinguished Māori rights in the foreshore and seabed. So if you consider the fact that Article 2 guarantees that all the pre-existing rights continue on after, then that would lead you to the conclusion that in 2004, the rights to the foreshore and seabed resided with Māori still. And that's just a fact of the nature of the treaty, of the law, and of today's parliament. And so the then Labour government just decided to not worry about that and legislated the foreshore and seabed into Crown ownership.
Would they have anticipated that? Did they anticipate what you just said there and made that change because they could see?
They knew it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they knew it. They just chose to ignore it. And we're seeing a lot of that.
Yeah, but they
now.
changed things, right? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So just the simple technicality, the mechanism of it. Parliament hadn't passed the law to extinguish the Māori rights, so the Māori rights still existed. And then they extinguished them in 2004 without any consultation or anything with the treaty partner. So that gave birth to the Māori Party in 2004. And then the first iteration of the Māori Party, Tariana Turia, Peter Sharples, later on Tūruroa Flavel and Hone Harawira and then Marama, Rahui, they fought that for a long time and managed to get it amended in 2011 with the Key government, right? Only amended. So they were only trying to claw back, you know, any sort of scraps of what had been taken. And then John Key comes along and says, quite pragmatically, because the government had been saying up until then, the Crown owns it. Okay, and then John Key comes along and says, well, hey, why don't we say no one owns it? So no one owns it, right, and Māori can have their right to the customary title to the foreshore and seabed, but they have to prove these, ABC. And the highest hurdle in the ABC was this idea that Māori had to prove undisturbed possession or, you know, undisturbed control of their rohe moana, so their coastal boundary. Okay, so that's the test that Māori were given by the Key government in 2011. And then many tribes put their claims in and went along doing all the research and everything else required. And predictably, some of the iwi got over all of the hurdles and achieved formalising their customary rights in court, through court, to their foreshore and seabed in their rohe boundaries. And so what's happened now is the now government see that as a problem, that some of these iwi have got over all of those hurdles, and the High Court has granted them, you know, the courts have granted them these rights in law. Yeah, obviously, that's an impediment to the current government going around any piece of coast they like and doing whatever they choose. So that's a problem for them, right? So their solution to that is to void that precedent, you know, and to make the bar even higher than it already was. That's what they're proposing. And so what I've simply said is that, well, in fact, our rights were unlawfully taken from us in 2004. No legal body will argue with that. Our rights were unlawfully taken from us. And so actually, if the Crown wants to proclaim ownership over my iwi's coastline, then why don't they come and explain to us how they deserve it, why they should have it, and what the test is that approves them having it.
Yeah. So the default is that it's owned not by nobody, but by whoever was there before any signatures went anywhere. And now the onus is on kind of a reversal of the situation to prove why you should have it. It's a difficult one, though, isn't it, to sort out no matter what, because you know, it's so tied up in the whole perception of identity and lifestyle and history and culture. It's a tangled web, isn't it?
Well, it could just come down to being not such a tangled web and being based on what the treaty actually says. That makes it very less tangled. I take your point that the New Zealand identity and a whole raft of other things that could be added to this mix do complicate it a bit. But really, when you're talking about the rights we're talking about, it's not complicated at all. Now, that's not to trivialise the idea of national identity and, you know, the good old Kiwi summer holiday and all of that, the rights of New Zealanders in our own country. But you can't seek to protect those things and those rights by dismissing someone else's. That's a naturally flawed approach as well. But, you know, hey, I mean, what I'm telling you is just the 100% truth of court ruling over the last 20 years.
All right, but big job there. Okay, David Seymour's Charter Schools Bill. Where are you on charter schools? I guess forget the personalities, or maybe not, but as a concept anyway, where are you at on that?
Yeah, well, look, I've spent 20 years in education. My wife and I spent 10 years working for Te Wānanga o Raukawa. The first ever Māori tertiary education institute in New Zealand was established in 1981. We've also been involved in the establishment of two kura kaupapa Māori, you know, so schools for our children. And in my time in education, the majority of it was spent in senior leadership.
Right.
So when it comes to education, we know a lot.
Okay.
And not just know a lot, we've experienced a lot, we've done a lot, we've built a lot, we've battled a lot, we've championed a lot. And so I've been relatively quiet on the education front in the House thus far because I was giving them time to put something out. And unfortunately for them, they just haven't put out much. So let me get back to charter school idea. These are the things that prick my attention with regards to the charter school idea. Number one, you have a national-led coalition who are determined to standardize education. So standardizing delivery and standardizing testing. Now, the problem with standardization is twofold. The first big problem in it is that the standardization of education was a outcome of the post-army industrial revolution time. Okay, when largely jobs were factory-based, they were manual labor-based, they were hardworking people-based, and you needed an education approach that facilitated graduation into an economy that was built on that, industrialism. Yeah. Now, that's not the economy that exists today. And this is not like, these aren't my ideas. I'm just saying to you what 10, 15, 20 years worth of people, of experts around the world have been saying about education. So if you take that as the starting premise, the idea of standardization of delivery and standardization of testing is an outdated idea because it no longer marries into the existing economy.
Can you give me an example, Takuta, because I'm remembering back to when I was at school. Yeah, we had wood workshops and metal workshops, and the railways workshop was down the road. Many people were heading that way. The thing was kind of geared for that. And exactly as you were saying, I could see why it was set up like that. What are the differences now? I mean, where is that not necessary now? Can you give us
So a real easy one for you, and everyone will recognize it, is automation. So you no longer go into a fast food restaurant and get served by someone. Right. That's automation in action.
Yeah.
So they no longer employ those four young people at the front desk. A robot and a computer program does that. In some fast food places, they no longer employ people to package and deliver the food to you. A robot does that.
Yeah.
Some of the giant retail organizations of today, Amazon, who else is in there? Oh, let's take Trade Me. Oh, no, maybe not Trade Me. They might not have got that high up. But Alibaba, Temu, these big
international
corporations, when you order a package from them, not one human hand touches that package. It's all wrapped, packed, programmed, delivered, sent, shipped, all by automation. So, you know, the revolution, the industrial revolution education model was primed for people who would have gone and done those jobs with their manual labor, and it no longer exists today.
Okay, so does that mean, I mean, where are the jobs going? Are they even going to, I know it's a bit of a diversion, but they're even going to be jobs?
Well, you know.
In the numbers anyway, in the numbers.
Yeah. It's a common you know, rebuttal to this idea, well, where are the jobs going? Well, in any economy, when a space opens up in one area, it creates opportunities or deficits in other areas, you know, and so the labor workforce moves around like that. And indeed, as things become more sophisticated and more, you know, manually orientated jobs get phased out, there will be more and more and more people not able to get into those workplaces. And if they don't upskill, they'll just be left behind, which is a pretty scary thing, right? You know, other manual jobs like logging. You know, there's still a lot of logging done by hand in New Zealand, but loggers have got the clock is ticking. There are machines that can pull a forest down quicker than anyone else. So, and these things are all reality, right? And the piece you're talking about is really, you get down to challenging the modeling that's allowed in economies. So big companies are currently allowed to employ technology to reduce their labor costs, reduce the wage cost. New Zealand agriculture and horticulture have been doing it for decades, been importing cheap labor to lower the labor cost to the organization. And you lower the labor cost, you improve the profit cost, the profit output. So there has to come a point where a government has to rationally think what they do, how much intervention or, you know, how much rules and guidance they put in place for economies and companies that operate in them. Many of them exploit them, you know, and what the ultimate and long-term impact of that is on the citizens of their country. So there's a lot in that.
Well, can
charter-type
schools be able to, I don't know what the word is, configure, tweak, go in a direction that moves away from what you're talking about, that's still standardization of what you say is from another era. It doesn't quite apply anymore. Though why people would carry on with something that's kind of redundant, I don't know, and you might have thoughts on that. But can the charter school thing bend away from that?
Well, the charter school is the idea is an okay idea. Because it's more flexible, you know, it's more agile in terms of being able to provide what's needed. Now, the traditional schooling system is not agile and is not flexible. The charter schools will be underreported and the state schools are overreported. All of these types of things, right? And the basic thing that sort of stands out to me, you know, glaringly obvious with regards to the government and ACT, is that the government have a central delivery, a standardization approach for the whole system, and ACT are putting up the complete opposite approach. So why would you be investing in two completely opposite things? And you're investing $16 billion in this one and $150 in that one. Surely that's
to see what works. To see what works.
Oh, but these have all been tried before, right? You don't need to test a charter school now. It's already been done. We already know what the outcome is. So,
well, it's a deal for government, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a deal for government. That's all it is.
Agreement.
And here's one of the other key things. It's the philosophy of education. Education, you know, learning isn't a transaction. You don't put in A, B, C and naturally get out E, F, G. You know, it's a transaction. Many will describe it as a relationship between a teacher, someone capable and experienced, and a learner.
Yep.
And the learner has to be open, willing, and happy and enjoying the experience of learning. So those two things, those two things are at each end of the education and learning spectrum. And so standardizing the delivery discounts and cuts out the capacity of the teacher, the passion of the teacher, the ambition of the teacher, the innovation of the teacher, all of these things about the teacher, you know, the level of duty of care the teacher has, the way they treat their students, the environment they create within a classroom, it cuts all of that out.
Yeah,
and it just says, here you go, here's the paper, teach this, you know, A through to Z, and here's the test this A to Z. And that actually does the teacher a disservice.
Well, you don't even really need to be a teacher, you're more of a facilitator.
Well, that's right.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. And more importantly, it does the student a disservice. Because the student has to be happy, they have to feel safe, they have to feel motivated, they have to feel engaged in order for any decent learning to happen.
Yep.
And standardizing everything cuts all of that out. So that's the, you know, those are the sort of at the core problems that I see with the government's approach to education.
Yep.
I'll just add to that by saying our time in education has been in, like my professional time in education, has all been in Māori education.
Yep.
So be that in a Māori organisation or delivering Māori education in non-Māori organisations, so institutes of technology and also universities. And this government really, really poorly has not put anything into Māori education. And Māori education, or kaupapa Māori education, and when I say that, I'm talking about kōhanga reo, I'm talking about kura kaupapa, which is the equivalent to a primary school. A kura a iwi is another equivalent to a primary school. A whare kura is an equivalent to a secondary school. Whare wānanga, equivalent to a tertiary provider. those models of education have all outperformed the mainstream delivery of education for Māori by far, by the degree of 15 to 20%. 15 right. to 20% higher success for Māori.
Got the numbers
in those
on
modes of education than in the mainstream for 30 years plus now. So all of the evidence and experience is there. There's just hasn't been a government willing to put the money where the mouth is to date.
Yeah, well, if it works, really, that's all that matters in the end, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, well, that should be
go
all
on
the
doing the same thing that doesn't work all the time. That doesn't make any sense.
No, not at all. But that's what we do. That's what the countries do. Kaupapa Māori education has consistently, over the last three decades, achieved 15 to 20% higher results for Māori than the mainstream.
Right, got it.
So yet it's never been given any money. They got less than 1% of the current budget.
So the charter schools thing is just throwing a bit of meat to a coalition partner.
Yeah, really? That's all it is. It's all it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, okay. All right, time's against us as always. The Treaty Principles Bill, again, Seymour, his name comes up again. It's been amended to recognise the rights of iwi and hapu that existed prior to the signing of the treaty. Is that a positive, in your view? Does it win any support from Te Pāti Māori?
Oh, it doesn't need support. It's already there. As I said, first off, in our kōrero, in this discussion, I explained about the rights of Māori, the pre-existing rights of Māori, guaranteed to continue after the signing of the treaty in Article 2. So basically, if you understand that, you know that what Seymour and the government are proposing is a protection of hapu and iwi rights is actually not a protection because it's protected by the treaty. And what they're proposing is that the hapu and treaty and the hapu and iwi rights will be protected to the degree that they exist in any law. Okay, so that's a different thing again, because that's parliamentary law they're talking about. But those very rights are guaranteed to continue undisturbed in Article 2 of the treaty. So it's a pointless addition.
So laws could be changed at any time too, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay. No, I think it's clear where you're coming from there. The issue of the Privileges Committee.
Yeah.
You were recently referred to that committee for inferring that members of the government were liars. Apparently that's against the rules.
Yeah.
Though maybe they are. I don't know. Can you give us an update on what happened there and what that means? How bad is it? Are you in the naughty chair? Is that really what that means?
Yeah. You're in the naughty box. But here's the thing. I didn't call them liars. I called them obfuscators.
Okay. Well, that's a different thing.
Yeah. Winston just picked up on it because I said obfuscation sounds like lying.
Right. Yeah.
And so he made it out as though I said they were liars. But all I said was that many people in that house are master obfuscators.
Yep.
And so it's been given to the Privileges Committee. I don't know much about the Privileges Committee. Never been there. We'll just, you know, I'll go along and see what it means and what you do. But that's I know what I wrote and it's written, so I can put it in front of them. And if I need to go and get a top-level literary or professorial opinion about what it says in terms of the writing, well, I'm happy to do that too. But, yeah, I'm pretty clear. I said that many in the House were master obfuscators. And so if the Speaker of the House is saying that I did say that many were liars, then he'll have to come up with a he'll have to explain the difference between obfuscation and lying.
Yeah. It's about a halfway point to lying, my gut tells me.
Well, yeah, it's the dictionary explanation of what obfuscation is. And it's making something ambiguous. It's deliberately concealing the truth to confuse others. Everything you could imagine before you cross over to actually lying.
Yeah.
Deliberately.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, sounds, I'm not too worried
sounds
about
like
it,
mate. a bit of a storm in a teacup, that one may be. But they like the media sort of likes that kind 100%. Of buzz, don't they?
Yeah. It's good for New Zealand Feast.
Yeah. Yeah, what do you make of Winston at the moment? I mean,
Oh, I think time is
There's a little bit of RG, a bit of combativeness between you guys, between your party and New Zealand First in the house.
Yeah.
I see
but
it.
He's just
regularly.
Stuck in a very old model, and society has moved on. And I doubt that he wants to move with it. Part of the thing that Winston, like in Winston's, I think, general debate, he had a real dig at us. He had a real dig at us and the Greens for not wearing clothing that matches his.
Right.
You know, he had a dig at people wearing hats and people wearing pink and people wearing, you know, a strapless, you know, top and people being in bare feet, people wearing T-shirts. You know, he had a complete rant at it. But the thing is, how we dress is how the people of today dress, respectfully.
Right.
Like none of us look like we shouldn't be in there. We're just a different generation of operation. And Winston wants it to be stuck way back there when it's moved on. And the reason most young people don't engage with Parliament is because they don't look like them. Don't sound like them.
No point. It wasn't you.
No, it was Hannah. So, no, she had like a nice top on, but it just didn't go over the shoulders.
Yeah. Well, they like the old coat and tie.
Yeah,
you know,
coat, tie, white
coat
shirt,
and
all of that.
Yeah.
They call it business attire, you know?
Yeah, business attire. You're not even allowed to sit in the audience, are you, without wearing...
God, I don't
this
know.
Is how I remembered it back in the day anyway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that may have changed a little.
Well, society's moved on and Parliament should catch up.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.